The way you learned a song is how you sing it, not necessarily how it's written. And on that song there that we just sang, I always want to sing at the end, power and strength to the Lord, you know, like that. But I thought that's probably not a good idea. I'd like for you to open your Bibles to Genesis 4. And while you're doing that, let me again welcome you. I'll tell you what, this has been a great week for me. I hope that it has been for you as well. As we've said, almost every lesson, God created us as social creatures, and that our lives are intertwined and made up of many different relationships. I think we've covered, and with this lesson, we'll have covered most of the major relationships that we can find ourselves in. There's obviously others. There's the employee-employer, master-slave relationship. There's the political relationship that we have as citizens and the government. There's relationships as neighbors, relationships even as enemies, that we are told how we are to treat those who, by the way, from my point of view, how we treat those who view us as an enemy. I don't have any enemies. But some people look at me as being an enemy, so I have to view them in a certain way. But the principles that we've covered in all of these will apply there. And again, I want to thank the elders for the invitation. Thank you all again for your attention and your diligence in your study, and most of all for accommodating me with my need to keep my social distance and all of that. I so much appreciate that. And listen, it was a sacrifice for me too, because I didn't get that steak dinner at the Sick Dishes. And that has become almost a tradition, and I missed that a lot. But it's just one of the things, it's part of the sacrifices that we have to make sometimes to help others. This morning we looked at the oldest relationship, the first one created by God, and that's the husband and wife relationship. We pointed out there that is the preeminent human relationship that we can have. It's number one on our list. It trumps every other relationship, whether we're talking about with our parents or our friends or best friends that we've had all of our life. That also includes trumping the relationship we're going to be talking about tonight. Husband and wife relationship trumps the relationship that we have as parents to our children. So my need to cleave to my spouse, the cleaving isn't loosened or removed because we've got children. That in fact, my children need to see that I love their mom, and that she loves me, and that we have this commitment to each other, and that we are a team. We're not separable. So we are looking at the second oldest one, which is Christians' relationship with their children, the parent-child relationship. And I feel for Adam and Eve in this, because just like with the marriage, they didn't have a model. They weren't children of somebody else. They didn't get to see what parenting looks like as they were growing up, because they were created full grown. They also had never had children before until these came along. And just like most of us, parenting is kind of a thing that you learn as you go. But God's provided us everything that we need about being a parent, and from many different points of view. Listen, there's enough information about the parent-child relationship that it could be its own series of lessons. And so we're going to have to be pretty generic as we go along. I could have had a whole lesson, for example, on discipline, the discipline of children. Another, as we looked at the different stages of childhood and their development and what they can accept and know and learn and what can be expected of them. Another lesson surrounding the various myths that are attached to parenting, like good parents don't have problems with their kids. What a myth. That's such a joke. A whole lesson on training up a child. I mean, listen, there's all kinds of angles that you could come to this topic. So we're not going to be delving real deeply, but we'll touch on a lot of that. And as I said Wednesday night, and we'll reiterate now, we're not going to be looking at this from the child's point of view towards the parent. This is just going to be from our point of view as as parents ourselves. And again, I get to speak to you from the standpoint of some experience in this. I have three children. My youngest one, wow, is going to be 36 a week from tomorrow. I remember when I was preaching in Eugene, Oregon, we had a woman there that was having her 90th birthday, and church kind of got together, and I had known about this woman all my life. I mean, her husband, her first husband, had been the one who taught my dad to preach. So after, you know, we were having the celebration, everybody wants her to make a speech, and she looked around and she said, well, first thing I have to say is I can't believe all these old people here are my kids. So I guess when you're 90, you have children that are 70 or 65 or something like that, you know, you might feel that way. And I can't believe that my youngest is 36 or going to be. So here's how I'd like to proceed. I always like to kind of give you a heads up. I'm going to talk about the basis of this relationship. What causes there to be a parent-child relationship? Discuss the responsibilities that parents have toward their children, and also discuss the goals and objectives that we as parents ought to have for our children. And hope that as we go through this, that we'll learn about things that are crucial at particular times and what can be a difficult circumstance for us sometimes. So let's read our text. And I only read it because this is where the children began. And Adam lay with his wife Eve, and she became pregnant in Genesis 1 and verse 4, and gave birth to Cain. She said, with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man. Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now, Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, but Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. You as parents have never seen that, have you? Never seen your child just go, you know, make that face. Looks like they're going to cloud up and rain. And the Lord said to Cain in verse 6, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, and you must master it. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. And so you can see that the parent-child relationship can have some pretty traumatic circumstances. So I want to also let you know that to make our study as profitable as possible, I'm going to be using as a model the perfect parent tonight, and that is God. And I want you to pay attention, especially as we get towards the end of the lesson, the important things that we can learn from that. So let's look at the basis of this relationship. And most of us, I think, if asked what's the thing that motivates or instigates the parent-child relationship, most of us would say that at its root it's biological. In the family as God designed it, you have a man and a woman who are married, and they, as God said in chapter 1 and verse 28, and then reiterates again in chapter 9 and verse 1, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And it's as simple as that. And while that may be the nature of some parenting relationships, it's not the complete answer. And in fact, I would suggest to you that everyone in this room is extremely happy that that's not the only reason and the only basis for a parent-child relationship. There are varying reasons, varying bases for this relationship that can happen with God. In Luke, the third chapter and verse 38, assuming that Luke is inspired, which I certainly do, in Luke chapter 3 and verse 38, when he's giving the genealogy of Jesus, I'll get over there real quickly here. He says at the very end of verse 38, the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. And so God calls himself the father of Adam. And the reason for this, the basis for this, is God created Adam. So he gets to be called the father. And that's very true. And in a very real sense, he was his father. In John the third chapter in verse 16, we do have God seen as a biological father. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. Some of your translations, mine says one and only son, but the Greek word there is monogenes, which means only begotten. There's not getting around that. It's literally that. So we see God as being a father in the scriptures on the basis of biology. But then if you go with me over to Ephesians chapter 1, and look at the latter part of verse 4. It says, in love, he predestined us to be adopted as his sons through Jesus Christ in accordance with his pleasure and will, to the praise of his glorious grace, which he has freely given us in the one that he loves. And so we have been predestined, we have been adopted by God, which is why I said just a moment ago that we're extremely grateful that our relationship with God doesn't have to depend on biology. It also underscores, for me, why I have so little patience with people who oppose adoption or count adopted children as less than children. I have family members that did that. You know, we go to a wedding. I went to a wedding. I was at my youngest uncle's wedding. Listen, I have to tell you this. I get to share my angst every once in a while. I have been in filled three positions in weddings in my life. In this particular wedding, I was the ring bearer. I think it was like four. And then I have also been the groom once. And then I have been the minister. I have never been the best man. I've never been a groomsman. I don't know what I'm missing, but I've never been up there with those guys. But we had a picture taken after the wedding that I was a ring bearer in, and I had no idea. I had a cousin who was the daughter of my uncle's wife, who he had adopted, but she wasn't blood. And so when the family picture was being taken, she was set aside. When my grandfather died, she wasn't included in descendants. I'll tell you what, nothing fires me up more than that. Mostly from people who are Christians who have been adopted by God. And in fact, God doesn't see any difference in that. In Romans 8 chapter and verse 17, we are co-heirs with his son, Jesus Christ. So don't get me started on this, because I've already got started on it. Listen, if they're adopted, they're yours. And the adopted parent is their mother and their father. Biology. Tell you what, parenting is much more, in my view, nurture than nature. And of these three, we can find ourselves as parents in these last two. We're not usually creating kids ourselves, and so they're either going to be ours as a result of biology or adoption. In either case, the responsibilities are equal and basic for all of those children, and that's where we're moving to next. Parental responsibilities. And the first, and I'm going to use God again as my illustration, and then we'll look at ourselves as we go through this. You'll see what I'm talking about. So the first responsibility is to provide. That's a parent's obligation, to provide for their children. And with Adam and Eve, we see God doing that. He provided all that they needed. In Genesis, the second chapter, in verse 9, the Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. In the middle of the garden, there was a tree of life, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and God provided all of that for them. He gave them responsibility. They were to tend and care for the garden, and he met their relational needs. We saw that this morning. He provided everything that they needed. He was the perfect parent for them. With the Jews, he gave them a land that flows with milk and honey. In fact, he challenged them in Malachi, the third chapter. He said, bring in the whole tithe. Test me in this, he said. And see that if I do not open the gates and the windows and the doors of heaven and pour out on you a blessing that you cannot even receive. He always, don't you realize and don't you recognize that God provides us all more than we need? And he certainly did for them. He provided and fulfilled every promise and provided for their needs. And towards us, in Ephesians chapter 1 and at verse 4, right before what we started reading a moment ago, for he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. And he has, actually verse 3, he has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in Christ. He gives you spiritual nutrition. He gives you spiritual relationships. He gives you spiritual work. He gives you hope. He gives you purpose. He gives you encouragement. And he challenges us as well. I love this passage in Luke chapter 6 and verse 38. I used to call this my potato chip illustration. Not much anymore. But I'll explain that in a second. In chapter 6 and verse 38, Jesus says, given it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down and shaken together, running over will be poured into your lap. This is how God deals with us. When I was growing up, you got potato chips in a cardboard box with two clear bags inside. And when you pull those bags out and you looked at them, you think, they didn't fill these up. They're like two-thirds or a half full. What's going on? If you look at the fine print on the outside of the potato chip, and probably it's still there on bags today, this is sold by weight, not by volume, it'll say. Some settling may occur in between the time we filled it and you get it. Now, that's not how God works with us. That's what it says here. When he gives you potato chips, he puts them in the bag and then he goes, he shakes it. He puts it down and then he pours some more in and shakes it. And he, maybe not the best idea for potato chips, but he mashes it down so he can put some more in so it will be overflowing. That's how God deals with us as a parent. So I ask you, how are you doing as parents? And specifically, I want to address the fathers here. Are you treating your children like God's treated you? Do you provide them with everything they need? All the food they need, clothing, shelter, those are the easy ones. How about companionship? How about relationship? How about a quantity of time in which quality can occur? I'm going to talk about that again in a moment. Is there love? Is there long-suffering? Is there discipline? And when I say discipline, I mean all three kinds. I mean that you're instructing them and you're correcting them and then they're giving them consequences when they need it? Are you providing for them a role model? And an example that they can respect? You know, it says, children, obey your parents and in the Lord, honor them. Listen, if you want that, the best way to get that, live honorably. Help them succeed and flourish. And again, that's going to be also seen in how the mother and dad treat each other. The second thing that parents have to do is to protect their children. And God protected Adam and Eve. He placed them in this beautiful garden. And the one thing that was a danger, he clearly warned them about. And you say, but what about which was the eating of that tree? Don't eat that, you know. You say, well, what about the serpent? Now, let me say, first of all, if you're going to give people the freedom of choice, you have to give them a choice. You go to Baskin and Robbins 31 flavors, you walk in there and you see 31 cartons of vanilla. you're going to say, where's my choice? So if you want them to choose you, you have to have an alternate choice available. And even in providing that, he equipped them to deal with the temptation. Was he not clear in his instructions? Don't eat that tree. Don't even touch it. In the day that you do, here's the consequence, you'll surely die. And was he not before that clear in his love for them and provision for them so that all that Satan comes along saying, they could say, you're crazy. That's not the God I'm serving. He's nothing like what you're describing. God protected the Jews. He was their protection. He was their guardian. And again, they only had to accept him as that, but the Jews consistently turned to Egypt. They turned to Babylon. They turned to someone else to provide for them the protection that they thought they needed. Even impotent idol gods. And he protects us. In 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, in verse 13, listen, God said, I will not allow you to be tempted above what you're able to bear, but will, with the temptation, provide also a way of escape. So there's God protecting us. I'm not going to let you have that. That temptation is not going to be able to touch you. And if there is a temptation, he's either going to give you the way of escape or the strength to endure it. But again, we get to choose. We get to choose whether we're going to do that or not. And so with us and our children, are you protecting them? Listen, we live in a world right now with physical and cyber dangers. And you cannot be passive in your protection of them. Tell you what, if I had young children, they would not have a computer in their room with a door that closed. In fact, the computer would be out where everybody can see, with the screen out so I can see exactly what they're doing. I've got a grandson right now that he's been kind of chafing at the restrictions that my son and my daughter-in-law have put on him, and because he's not able to watch and do the things that all of his friends are doing. Thankfully, this last week he came up to and thanked them for that, because he saw some things that he wished he'd never seen because somebody showed them to him. You cannot be passive in your protection of your children. And you can't worry about them getting angry with you. And I'll tell you, children, I guess they are just born with the knowledge and the skill of divide and conquer and talk to the mom and talk to the dad and try to get them pitted against each other, which is exactly why I said what I said at the beginning. You can't be divided. You're the front line protection for them. When my kids were younger and the whole sex education thing came up and they were talking about it, listen, I was at those meetings. I was at those parent meetings. I said, no. I said, I've got a daughter here. I don't want her in this classroom with a bunch of boys learning about all of that. I said, they don't need to be in there learning about her with her there, or him, her about them with them in there. I don't care if you teach them about it, but you're going to separate them. I was the only parent that showed up that day. But they did what I asked. Squeaky wheels sometimes get the grease. You got to be your child's advocate. You got to be their protector. Nobody else is going to be. You also, as parents, need to teach and train and mentor and lead. We talked already about the fact that the purpose of family is to form persons, and specifically we're talking about forming the children in that family. And regardless of how they became members, whether they were born in your family or adopted, the responsibility sits squarely on the shoulders of the parents, and more specifically on the father, to form that child, to train, to teach, to mentor, and to lead. And God was that with Adam and Eve. I love that passage when God was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. It kind of indicates to me that was something that regularly happened. They had that close, intimate relationship with him, which is why there was no excuse for them to believe Satan. He's right there with them. He's spending time with them. With regard to the Jews, he gave his law to his people. He provided mentors. He provided prophets and leaders and high priests and kings to guide them. And there in Ephesians, the fourth chapter, he's done the same thing for us. He gave some to be apostles and prophets, some evangelists, some teaching pastors. To do what? To prepare us, to teach us, to build us up, to form us so that we could grow up into him and be like our head. And we have to do the same with our children. And I'll tell you what, this, especially the training, teaching, mentoring, leading, is the others are going to be necessary as well. But there's one thing that requires, and that's time. It takes time for you to do that. People are always saying, "Well, I try to make quality time with my kids." Here's a news flash for you: you cannot schedule quality time. Quality time takes place in a quantity of time, and you don't even know when it's going to happen. But in this large quantity of time that you're spending with your kids, there's a chance you're going to have some quality time in there. There's a guy by the name of Brooks Adams. He was the ambassador to Great Britain under Abraham Lincoln. And when he was a little boy, his father, you know, encouraged him to have a daily journal to write down, you know, a diary, but a journal that every day he would write something that happened that day. And he started doing that from a young age. In fact, it was that journal that was used when his biography was written. And here's what was written on one particular day in his journal. He said, "Went fishing with my father. The most glorious day of my life." Now, his father also kept a daily journal, and he had a journal entry for that same day. And his journal said, "Went fishing with my son. A day wasted." Quantity time, but from the son's standpoint, the best day of his life. Listen, as a father, you never know the impact you're going to have. And the more time that you spend with your child, the more opportunities that you're going to have that time is going to be quality. My grandsons came to visit me this year. They came this summer. They came separately. Listen, when they're 9 and 11 or 8 and 11, you don't want them there at the same time. Not if you're 60-some years old. Okay? And so I took each one of them fishing. And the youngest one was there first. We caught a bunch, you know, and we brought him home and I cleaned him up and I cooked him for him that day. And the older one came and he's all excited to go fishing, and we went fishing and we didn't even get a bite. And I felt horrible about that. But I said, that's why it's called fishing and not shopping. Because sometimes you don't catch anything. So what they wanted to do the next time I came down is there was an Oriental store that just opened up, and they sold live fish there. And so they wanted to go down with me and pick out a tilapia out of the fish tank there, and we were going to bring it home. So we went down and I picked out one, and the guy that's behind, you know, has got it in the bag. He says, "Want me to kill it?" And I said, "No." I said, "My grandsons here want me to kill it and clean it and cook it." So we did. I took it home with them, you know, and I did what I always do with fish, and I cleaned him up, and I filleted out the meat, and we cooked it on the frying pan. And I'll tell you what, within 30 minutes of the store and 30 minutes, we were eating fish. I said, "Man, you're not going to get fresh fish like this." If my grandfather had ever done that with me, I would not ever have forgotten it. And I told my son, I said, I think this is one of those days, one of those occasions when something special is going to be remembered. And you just have to spend the time to do that. And that's what Ephesians, the 6th chapter in verse 4, is all about. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. How has the Lord trained you? How has he instructed you? You have to do the same. You have to be fair. You have to be consistent. You don't want to exasperate them. I don't, by the way, put dad jokes in the exasperation category. You're leading and guiding your children. You're not driving them. You're not forcing them. And listen, again, they get to make choices, especially as they get older. I made choices that my dad didn't like. My son has made some choices that I didn't care about. But he gets to make them. I got to make mine. And the other side of this is obvious. There can't be any neglect. There can't be any abuse. There can't be any leading your child astray. God doesn't tempt us, James 1 says, so you don't tempt your children. In fact, God goes beyond that. In fact, we find out that he won't even allow, not only does he not tempt us, he won't allow an outside temptation to approach us if we can't bear it. And we need to be careful about that with our own children. And again, remember that this is a two-sided relationship. I'm sorry, you only get one shot with your child. I don't know how many people, because I experienced it with three kids, about the time they get interesting, they leave. About the time you can talk to them and have a conversation with them, they're out the door. So make sure you make the most of it. And let me add one more important part to parent responsibility. I want you to think about the three major times or three major examples that we see of God as a father in the Bible. We see him as a father with Adam and Eve. And they sinned. We see God as a father with Israel and Judah. And they left and went off and worshiped idols. And we see God depicted in the parable of the prodigal son. And he went off and wasted his money. And if you look at those three examples, you might conclude that God was less than a perfect parent. And if you think that, you would be exactly wrong. You'd be exactly wrong. Because he could not have done more. He could not have been more loving. He could not have been more generous. In fact, the fault lies entirely with willful children who made decisions that led them to the disobedience and led them to their own destruction. And the reason I bring this up is because I know parents who beat themselves up, godly parents who beat themselves up over their own children's choices. And then they take full responsibility for the mistakes or the errors or the poor judgment that their children have made. And let me tell you, if you're doing that, you are not responsible for the choices your children make when they're grown. Godly parents that I've seen, they've done all that they could, and yet they always ask, what could I have done more? What more could I have done? How could I have changed? And what adds to their pain is the wagging tongues of other people in the congregation that say, well, you know, they look at how their kids turned out. You know, there's some kids that turn out really well in spite of the horrible job their parents have done. And there's some kids that just go down the tubes even though their parents were godly and did everything that they could. And the reason is because their kids got to make the choice. All children get to choose for themselves and are responsible for the consequences. Now, if you really did fail, If you really look back and you say, right there, that's the spot. That was the place I made a wrong decision. I should have done something differently there. Then here's what you need to do. You go to God and you ask Him to forgive you. Then you go to your children and you ask them to forgive you. And then you do what God did. With all of these three, you wait and you pray and you hope. And when they come back, you welcome them with open arms and forgive them and include them in your family again. And in the meantime, if they're not coming back, you continue to instruct them and warn them and, use your best judgment on that. I've known parents that the more they harped on their children, the further they drove them away. You know your kids' temperaments better than anybody else. You know what approach will work the best. Wow, look at me. I was preaching there, wasn't I? So let's look at, there's the key. You're not responsible for your children, your grown children's conduct. They get to make their choices. So let's look at some goals and objectives that we have as parents for our children. First of all, we want them to grow to be like us in positive ways. We would like them to share our faith, not as little automatons, you know, that are doing exactly what we're doing, but because they have their own, like, precious faith. They've developed that, and they have dedicated themselves to God's service as His children. And we talked about that this morning. God doesn't have any grandchildren. We want them to share our work ethic. Perhaps not the same work, not the same line of work. You know, sometimes we do that, you know. Want them to follow us into the family business or what have you. And, you know, kids have different talents and different desires. You know, they're not going to be your little helper, you know, that's going to just follow you and love the same stuff that you love. Their aptitudes may take them down a different path than what you took. But you want them to have a work ethic so whatever they pursue, wherever they are going, that they're going to grow in it and they're going to be as dedicated to it as you are to your job. You want them to share our love of family. You know, we've been talking about dysfunctional families. I'm pretty sure that my family was dysfunctional. I hardly have anything to do with my siblings. There was a lot of competition in my family. A lot of competition. And my father was too worried about one of us getting the big head, that so he never praised us. Oh, he'd praise me to my brothers and sister, and he'd praise them to me. That's really good. That engenders competition. So we were not a close family. Still aren't. So we need to hope that they share our love of family and to find a companion. That's my goal for my kids, was my goal. They're all married now. To find a companion that will enrich their lives and make them better. Enrich their lives, make them better, and leave me. Leave their father and mother and form their own families, their own homes. That's the goal. That's God's plan. And to enjoy good times and in the bad times to trust God and trust each other and lean on each other. And the end result in a parent's objective, at least in mine, is that they'll be faithful to God. That they'll love Him and that they'll serve Him. That they'll love their fellow man and serve others as they have the ability and opportunity. That they'll continue the family, that they'll... I had some peers that were a little bit older than us, and they got grandkids before Robin and I got grandkids. And so when we'd go on vacation or stuff, you know, they're stopping in every toy store and every boutique and going in and buying stuff for their grandkids. And I said, come on, can't you just enjoy a little time with adults? And then I had grandkids. That loud sucking sound is my bank account. I have seven grandkids. So my daughter, who had twins, one of the twins died at 1 month. But I have three that are surviving, that were born into our family, and I have three that were adopted in our family. And the one that's adopted is thinking about adopting another one. So I would have eight then, and I'd have four and four. What a balance. What a great thing. And I love them all. I love them all. And I'm hoping and I'm seeing that my kids are raising their kids differently than I raised them. They've seen my mistakes and they're avoiding those, and I'm really glad for that. And they're doing a good job, and their kids are growing up. And listen, my goal for a parent and for them is the same as God has for me. It's that I want them to, from Colossians 3, I want them to love God and their neighbor. I want them to have loving spouses and enjoy the joys of married life. I want them to raise children that are respectful of them. And in turn, I want them to be great parents. That's pretty much it. Listen, parenting is a difficult job, and for the most part is learned on the job. You get better at it as you go along, I'll tell you that. And you'll really discover that in your life if you have more than one. You know, my son, he was the guinea pig in the whole process. By the time the third one came along, man, she had it made. It's just the way it works. You know, you learn which battles are important and what's not so earth-shattering. And while we are learning the practical aspects while we're doing it, we do have the perfect role model in God. Listen, I know that we have plenty of other models around us, and I will tell you, I've been very frank with you, that some of those models are really bad. And I'm hoping that you recognize them and say, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to make those mistakes. But there's going to be positive examples, positive models in your circle of acquaintance where you see parents that are doing things that are really wonderful. And you say, wow, we should try that. Everybody's got these great ideas. Well, just open your eyes and you'll find them. I'll tell you, one of the great things that we did, one of the things, I'll just share this with you, is we got our kids, when they were a little bit older, little notebooks, you know, with a spiral top on it. And each night we would read a proverb, a chapter. And then everybody in the family would pick a verse out of that proverb and copy it down, draw a little illustration of what they saw. And then as a family we shared, you know, this is what I see. This is the proverb that stood out to me. This is the thing. And my kids still have those books. And I still look at mine. And what great time that was. When Mindy was just a little tiny thing and we would have our Bible class with Nathaniel and Megan, you know, we would tell our little Bible story, and she's just toddling around. She's not really paying attention, you wouldn't think, you know. And then we would get to the end and we'd say, okay, let's have a prayer. And wherever she was, she'd just go. Because it was time to pray. Listen, it's every child is different. Every child, even in the same family, is different. I remember we had Nathaniel, and then we had Megan, and we found out that we were going to have Mindy, and Robin said, well, at least it's another girl, you know, and so, you know, I've had a girl already. Mindy's completely different than Megan is. I mean, they're just so different. I'm always thrilled to offer people God as the perfect Father. and Jesus Christ as the perfect older sibling. And I know that there's a lot of people that you're going to meet in your life as you're sharing the gospel or sharing your life as a Christian, that they have had less than stellar family histories. And it's so wonderful for people who never had a father that they could trust or had problems with a sibling, and you can say, this is one you won't have a problem with. You can call on him anytime. He's always going to hear you. He's always interested in what's a bother to you. And his heart is big enough to love everyone. They're long enough to embrace every single person that comes to him, and he wants them all to be a part of his family. I love the fact that outside of God's house, there's never a no vacancy sign. Can always come in. I probably have that up there. There we go. We've talked about a lot of relationships since Wednesday. And there's relationships that you have with Christ. There's relationships you have with God. There's relationships you have as a congregation. There's relationships you have as parents and as children, as spouses. And I will tell you, if God is a part of that relationship, it's going to be the best it can be. I've never understood. One of the great mysteries to me are nations like China and that are atheistic, basically. And I just wish I could just get with them and talk with them and let them know. You know, if you let God into this nation, you're going to have better citizens. You're going to have people that obey the law and submit and are law-abiding. If you let God into your marriage is going to be better. If you let God into your family and parent as God parents and teach your children, it's going to be better. If you let God just be the absolute center of this congregation and Jesus Christ as the Savior, and you look to him and as we talked about before, you absolutely fall in love with them. That they're the ones that are important to you. You want to please them above everything. You would do anything for them. Those of you who are married, when you were dating, do you remember having those kind of, you know, your girlfriend or boyfriend, whoever it is, your fiance that you finally married, was there anything they could ask you that you wouldn't be interested in doing? Dan, can you pick me up from work and maybe we can go get something to eat? Nah, not tonight. No, there's a softball game I wanna go play. No, just drop it all and let's go. Well, that's how our relationship ought to be with God and Christ. You know, what do you want me to do? I'm ready to do it. I'm ready to do it now. And if you're part of the family of God, I hope that as we think of it and have been thinking about all of these relationships that we have, that you'll recognize that there is no relationship that's more important in life than with him and what you have with each other. Love God and love your fellow man. The whole law hangs on those two things. And if you need some help with that, if you need some encouragement with that, you want some prayers, or if you've got some issues that are going on, I'm going to take this off. I leave it up there every time. If you've got some issues that you're needing some help with, do not suffer alone. This is a family. Share it. Share it with somebody. Find somebody that you can have confidence in and seek some help. Sometimes all we need is somebody to listen to us. And I'm sure you've got people in here that are ears. You know, I know most of us like to be mouths, but there's some people that are just good ears, or they're good huggers, you know, and then that's their ministry. You know, go to those people. I mean, I just keep going on this. You know, husbands, when your wife is talking to you and telling you things that are going wrong. She's not sometimes asking you to fix it. And men, that's what we do. Okay, let me see what the problem is here. Are you done now? Okay, so here's what you need to do. They're not interested in that. They just want you to hear. They want you to be involved. They want you to know that they're struggling with this. And please be patient with me. They're not looking all the time for answers and for solutions. That's what we men do. We solve. So step back from that. Like, see, I could just keep going. You know, hours of stuff like that. So let's stop. And if there's some way in which you need help, you want help, want encouragement, then the song that's been selected is a great time, if you choose to do that, to let us know and let us help you with that. If you need that, please come while we stand and sing.